This is an ABC podcast.
A holiday to the Pacific. White sandy beaches, clear blue water, and a coconut to drink as you listen to the sounds of the ocean. It's marketed as paradise, and it's a huge moneymaker.
When tourism is 70% of your economy and GDP, it affects every man, woman, and child. These revenues that are derived from the industry, they support local businesses, they support local families, they support agriculture and services, and their money flows really underpins employment.
But behind the picture-perfect Instagram posts, a real challenge is brewing. More tourists means more pollution, fewer resources for locals, and damage to the environment.
There was a complaint about an irritation experienced by people initially swimming in the lagoon. I could show how lagoon was beginning to deteriorate, correlated with the growth in accommodation development along the coastline.
So how do countries juggle profit and preservation of their lands and ocean? Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk, where I'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it affects us all. I'll speak with politicians from across the Pacific region and with everyday people about political experiences that shape us. Today on Polytalk, we head to the Cook Islands, a country that has seen record tourism numbers in the last few years. But conservationists and tourism operators have noticed that with more visitors comes more challenges. So the country is trying to shift towards a more sustainable tourism model and discovering what it takes when you want to welcome the world without destroying your home. Spread across 15 different islands, the Cook Islands is an archipelago of pristine ocean, beautiful beaches, and a rich cultural heritage. And since it became self-governing, its leaders saw the tourism potential.
In 1965, when we became independent, a self-governing nation, the Premier at the time made a statement. We were largely, in 1965, an agricultural-based economy. And the aspiration in 1965, when we gained self-governing status, was an aspiration to become tourism-driven and become a tourism economy. And so from the early start, from more than 50, 60 years ago, was there an aspiration for tourism to lead our economy and lead our destiny.
Carla Eggleton is the CEO of Cook Islands Tourism, an organization mandated by the government to oversee the development of tourism in the country.
And so over the years, we have done that. And, you know, if we were going to be frank, it was like at any cost would we make tourism a thriving, successful tourism economy.
Since then, Carla says that dream has been achieved.
Tourism for the Cook Islands plays a significant role, particularly with our economy. You can describe it as the backbone of our economy, and it has been such since in the early 70s. Tourism currently contributes around upwards of 70% of the Cook Islands' GDP.
But as tourism grew in the country, Cook Islanders started to notice that their way of life and environment was beginning to unravel. Most notably, in the Moree Lagoon.
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. So the lagoon is turquoise, the beaches are white, there's a lot of trees and, you know, a lot of vegetation in the area, and it's the side of the island where the sun rises. So it's a really beautiful, picturesque place.
Jacqueline Evans is a legendary Cook Island conservationist and ocean advocate who says the Moree Lagoon is not only special to locals, it's a tourism hotspot as well.
It was previously a place where the local community would go and harvest seafood and have picnics. And also at one time there used to be horse races in Moree Beach. So yeah, it was very much a place that was used by the local community.
Villas and guest houses sit along the shore of the lagoon, and it's a popular place to swim and snorkel. But in the early 2000s, the lagoon started to change.
Well, in 2003, there was a complaint about an irritation experienced by people initially swimming in the lagoon, where they had stinging eyes when they opened their eyes under the water or swam in the lagoon on that side of the island, and had to rush to the hospital to have their eyes examined. And then later on in the day and the, you know, days following, people that were living on the land were actually experiencing this irritation in their eyes. Some people had breathing difficulties, and some of the tourists had to sort of check out of their hotels and move to another part of the island away from that area.
Jacqueline, what was causing this irritation in the water?
So a lot of investigations were done. A lot of, you know, people were suspecting it could have been pesticides or some kind of toxin or some sort of spill. But all the testing they did, they just couldn't find any evidence of that, and there was no real support for that kind of idea. So the New Zealand government actually helped us to try and investigate what the cause was, and they came down to a potential toxic algal bloom.
And what was this algal bloom doing to the lagoon environment?
So when there are too many nutrients in the water, and it causes algae to grow more rapidly, and it can die off, and bacteria will tend to break it down, and then the bacteria uses up oxygen in the water, which can cause fish to die off because they don't have the oxygen they need in the water. And algal blooms are also bad for, you know, smothering other marine organisms. So they prevent, you know, proper settlement of new coral larvae and, you know, the growth of other marine animals as well.
In the early 2000s, you studied what was happening. What did you find out about what was causing the algal bloom?
Yes, well, I had actually studied this back when I did my master's degree at the University of Hawaii. So I did my thesis on political ecology and basically the impacts of politics on the marine environment in the Cook Islands. And I used Muri as a case study where I looked at, you know, what the community living there had been observing and what the changes that had been happening over time were. So I was able to map the increasing density of accommodation along Muri Beach over time, and I was even able to quantify how much wastewater is produced by those properties over time, and I could show how the sort of observations of the community in terms of how the lagoon was beginning to deteriorate correlated with the growth and accommodation development along the coastline.
This toxic algal bloom came and went over a decade until in 2015 it got so bad that the Cook Island government declared it a national disaster. How did you feel when this happened?
My thoughts were finally, oh, finally, there's some recognition of this issue, because I remember as a young person being in Muri Beach with my friends. I remember we noticed there was a change. And so it was since then, and of course with my interest in marine biology, I've been looking into it and been trying to attract attention to the problem. And then finally it was right up until 2015 when the government, you know, decided that, yes, we need to call this an emergency because, you know, there are impacts from development happening on our marine environment, especially there in Muri.
Jacqueline says that at the time in Rarotonga, most houses and accommodation used septic tanks to get rid of waste. But as tourism numbers grew and development boomed, the sewer system wasn't able to keep up with the amount of people on the island, and waste had begun to leach nutrients into the lagoon.
Basically, because we don't have a sewerage system around the island, so like a main sewerage system that takes sewage away from properties and takes it to a treatment plant to treat, we have on-site wastewater treatment systems. So it was for a long time septic tanks, and then now we've got some properties that have proper treatment facilities on their property. But we've been developing as if we do have a sewerage system around the island. And what I mean by that is that when you've got on-site wastewater treatment systems, you can't have high-density tourist development, any kind of building that's going to accommodate a lot of people in a small space, because that's concentrating all the wastewater from those people into a very small area that's going to be, you know, where you treat your wastewater. Because every treatment plant has to have an outlet, and wastewater has to come out of that outlet, and it has to go somewhere.
The government responded by calling it a natural disaster and put in place frameworks to redesign the waste system. But in the decades since then, tourism has only continued to grow and the country continues to be stretched.
There have been a number of impacts I've noticed in the last 10 years or more. We're starting to experience that a lot of tourist destinations, local people that live there, begin to experience with growing tourism, and that includes, you know, reduction in water, you know, access to water, access to beaches, even tuna, you know, even eat food, you know, fish that we like to eat. You know, it's all going to the restaurants, and even parking, you know, at the airport, you know, for example, like the parking arrangements, the priority goes to tourists. It's really hard to get close to the arrivals area when you're a local, just going to pick up members of your family. Whereas, you know, we used to be able to just park right up to there and pick our family up and leave. Yeah, it's much different now.
Jacqueline's research and lived experience tells a broader story. Tourism growth in the Cook Islands hasn't just affected the Moree Lagoon. It's changed daily life across the islands, from water access to food security. In 2019, Cook Islands had its biggest tourism year, with more than 170,000 visitors, and the strain was becoming clearer, with locals competing for beaches, restaurants, and transport.
The sentiment that we could see and hear from our communities was that it was enough, that our infrastructure and our way of life was being stretched. That raised the question about, you know, when is enough enough and can we handle the numbers that we were getting?
Carla Eagleton became CEO of Cook Islands Tourism just as the borders reopened post-COVID, and she says the pandemic created a reset moment.
When we closed for COVID, along with a lot of other tourism destinations around the world, I think communities also had the opportunity to sit back and think more about what they wanted in their life and how they wanted their communities to operate. And there was a lot of sentiment, particularly in the social media space, from visitors and communities about how lovely it is to have their island back.
Carla, you said that the sentiment when Cook Islands became self-governing was that it became a tourism destination at any cost. How has that sentiment changed?
In the last 10 years or so, 5 to 10 years now, we recognise that that's not sustainable and that growing at any cost really puts pressure on the actual elements that make the destination desirable. Our pristine beaches, they need to be looked after, because that's one of the reasons why visitors come to the Cook Islands. Our well-entrenched culture and the way that we, and our communities and the way that we interact and engage, you know, it needs to be considered, because these are the reasons, the very reasons why people love being in the Cook Islands.
At the moment, Cook Islands has a set of values that guide how the country is responding to tourism and making the move towards sustainability. Can you explain those values?
So there's this this philosophy that we already have within us in our culture, what we call the Kia Ora values. Now, the Kia Ora values talks about sort of the way that we conduct ourselves, the way that we have been raised for respecting others, respecting the things around us, and making sure that we are good hosts. We have another value called Mana Tiaki, and that talks about our role as guardians and making sure that we understand that our role is to look after the people around us, look after the environment that keeps us nurtured and well. And then we have a third value, which talks about making sure that what we do is sustainable and that we are looking towards the future, that we have something to pass down to the next generation.
So using these values, what steps has Cook Island Tourism taken to pivot towards sustainable tourism?
So when we launched our first sustainable tourism development plan in October of 2022, we did so under the umbrella of the regional focus, and with our regional body, the South Pacific Tourism Organization, we looked at ways in which we could stamp clearly our intention to do better and be better in the sustainable tourism and development space.
What does that look like in concrete terms?
So for a number of years, we've had a Cook Islands Quality Assured program, and this was to give our visitors confidence in choosing accommodation properties that were going to provide quality accommodation for them. Back then, the definition of quality was a little different to what it is today, and it talked about cleanliness, it talked about supplies, facilities, amenities that are available within the rooms. Now we are looking at reviewing all of the, well, actually, we're in the process of reviewing all of that. And industry standards and guidelines now require or have now include environmental elements. What is the business doing or your property doing to play an active role in environmental management? How do you manage your waste? What areas of recycling and do you do? We are looking at redefining what growth means, and that is driving for quality visitors rather than quantity visitors. So the idea is increasing average length of stay. Perhaps growth won't look upwards towards numbers, but outwards across our islands, and that we are able to develop these islands in a way that our communities want to become involved in tourism.
And what has the response been from tourism providers and the wider country to this move towards more sustainable tourism?
Probably slower than what we would have liked, but positively overall. We really had to focus on recovery, recognizing that we had been closed as a country to the world for 2 years, and we had to build back our economy. And so I suppose that one of the reasons for the slow response to this work was we were really in recovery mode. But since we have now, 3 years on, really gotten to the point where we identified that recovery is now over, resilience is now our focus. And we are seeing from that shift from recovery to resilience, this desire and this active support to push ahead our sustainable endeavours.
Through strategies and cultural values like Kia Orana and Mana Tiaki, the Cook Islands is trying to move towards a sustainable tourism model. But as Carla admits, the move has been slow, and making sustainability real and not just a marketing slogan takes work. Across the Pacific, many countries are grappling with similar issues. Before the COVID pandemic, 1.8 million tourists visited the region, generating $2.4 billion in revenue. And the tourism economy is now rebounding. But with that comes concerns about how to manage this and keep the community and the environment thriving. The region's peak tourism body in the South Pacific Regional Organization launched a sustainable policy framework in 2021 that 20 Pacific countries are part of. But all countries are at different stages when it comes to implementing the practices. Like Cook Islands Tourism CEO Carla Eggleton says, Cook Islands is just starting to put things into practice. So what does this mean for the people on the ground and tourism operators in the country?
Kia ora nā tātou katoa. My name is Louisa Castanine, and I am the Managing Director at Ocean Tour Cook Islands.
For Louisa, sustainability isn't just a corporate policy. It's personal.
I grew up in one of the far northern group islands of the Cook Islands on a beautiful island called Manihiki. And Manihiki is known for its black pearls. So I was fortunate to be brought up on our family pearl farm. So for me, we've always known what it was like to grow up balancing both a livelihood and income, as well as balancing, you know, the intricacies of the environment to ensure that it always, one, is healthy, but can continue to provide for our family for generations.
Her tour business, which runs Turtle Swimming Experiences, was founded in 2022, and from the start has had sustainability at the heart of their work, including putting part of every customer's fee into conservation and education programs for local kids.
So strategically for us, we cap our numbers at 8. And we are intentional about also having the well-being of turtles at the forefront of our minds as well, in terms of how our footprint impacts the environment that we operate in. So we take our local kids swimming with turtles and rays in a safe environment, and we work closely with the schools to do this. So our students and our local children don't just go for a swim, but they also incorporate that into essay writing and into the education curriculum as well.
Louisa, right now, Cook Islands has strategies and values guiding much of its pivot towards sustainability. What impact has that had on you as a tourism provider?
So there's been greater education around that in partnership with Cook Islands Tourism. They have recently set up a destination stewardship plan and management scheme here within the country. And I was fortunate to be invited to some of the discussions around that. In those discussions, we discussed around about 10 tons of waste is generated every day here in the Cook Islands, and none of that rubbish or that waste leaves our shores. And so we're really looking at ways in which we can better manage that waste that's generated. And that comes with better, I suppose, government industries working closer together to prioritize and meet, you know, mutual objectives.
And what about regulation and legislation? Is more of that needed from the Cook Islands government to ensure that tourism providers like yourself commit to sustainable practices?
So strangely, my business has been actually petitioning government as well as our National Environmental Service and our Marines Resources Organization to implement regulations in the passage around the number of turtle tour operators that can function in that space. We have been, you know, advocating for regulations actually to be implemented on the turtle tour industry. And the reason why we do that is we understand that the longevity of our industry is contingent on our environment being, one, sustained in a way that ensures the well-being of the turtles, that we are more proactive in how we can regenerate some of the impact that we have on there by minimizing, I suppose, the detrimental impact. So yes, regulation and legislation is important, especially when we're looking at a space where turtle tours has essentially exploded just in the last 4 years or so. And it's an area that's unregulated and one that does need to be regulated.
And what responses have you gotten from other turtle tour operators in this space? Are they on board with the idea of regulation, or have you come up against resistance?
There is a collective of us where at the moment the passage isn't regulated, but for consumer safety, customer safety, as well as environmental well-being and marine life well-being, Cook Islands Tourism proactively took a stance on implementing an MOU. So we implemented a guideline around you can only take 4 guests per qualified lifeguard, cannot operate in weekends because that ensures that we're giving the environment a rest. There's around about 8 operators that signed onto the MOU, and there are some who have opted not to sign the MOU.
And what response have you gotten from the government to your petition?
If I'm being completely transparent, I would say that the response has been extremely slow. And the challenge that we have in having anything be achieved is that where we operate is there is overlap between different industries. You know, there's a Cook Islands Tourism Corporation component, there's a National Environmental component, there's a Marines Resources component, there's a police intervention and enforcement component. And so sometimes the delay comes when several ministries are all having to work together to implement something when they all have, one, limited budgets, but also conflicting priorities as well.
Providers like yourself make an income from tourism, but there's a realization in the country that if left without guidelines around sustainability, it puts it all at risk. What do you hope to see in the future of Cook Islands when it comes to the balance of the tourism dollar and conservation?
I think It's a very difficult one because for me, one of the key charms and beauties of Rarotonga and the Cook Islands is that we are so untouched. And sometimes when you have an increased volume of visitors, your hand almost gets forced into development. One of the key things is that there is a fine, fine balance between tourism and the pursuit of income generation, but also that income generation takes its toll on our environment, and it's always a fine line and a fine balance. For me, I would like to see that visitors come with a more conscious way of consuming in the Cook Islands. And what I mean by that is, how can they come and leave just footprints in our sand versus what they can bring, how they can consume in a way that is always about taking. But we are also appreciative of the income that tourism does generate. And I feel like we have a huge reliance on tourism, but I would like to see our government step into other industries that mean that all our eggs aren't in one basket.
Louisa explains sustainability, conservation and regeneration are all part of the tourism discussion at the moment. But there is still division about how best to achieve this. And from her perspective, it means the transition has been slow. Politok has reached out to the Cook Islands government to ask how it views the balance between economy and sustainability and to respond to claims that regulation in the tourism space hasn't been as quick as some would like. But we haven't received a response. Tourism built the modern Cook Islands. It remains the economic lifeline for 70% of the country's income. But the story of Moree Lagoon reminds us, without strong protections, paradise can unravel faster than we think. Sustainability isn't just a buzzword here. It's the difference between having an economy and having an environment to support it. Change is happening, from government strategies to grassroots businesses like Louisa's. But the shift is slow, and the question remains: as visitor numbers climb even higher, will the Cook Islands be able to keep paradise paradise? Politok is hosted by me, Scott Wide. Our producer is Kunta Murray Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna. Next week on Politok: Donald Trump's second term as U.S. president has sent shockwaves around the world.
From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world.
At the start of 2025, he signed dozens of executive orders.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty.
From cutting aid funding to pulling out of climate change agreements, moves that are putting vital programs around the Pacific at risk. And it has climate activists around the Pacific sounding the alarm bells.
You know, America is no doubt one of the biggest countries contributing to the climate crisis. And so I'd say it was very important for America to be a part of the Paris Agreement.
On Politok with me, Scott Wide. Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.